This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Tom Bullock in for Mike Collins. First, it was voter ID, then congressional districts. For the second time in 7-day span, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled against North Carolina lawmakers on an issue involving politics and race. Yesterday, the High Court upheld a lower court ruling, which found two congressional districts, the first in Northeast North Carolina and the 12th, including parts of Charlotte, were illegal racial gerrymanders. The decision on the first was unanimous. The ruling on the 12th was split 5-3, and the reasons for each are varied. With the 2020 census not that far away and the redistricting for Congress and state legislative seats that census will kick off, legal experts and others are still trying to suss out what this decision means for North Carolina and other states. And today, we'll try to do the same. Joining us on the line from Raleigh are Professor Guy Charles. He is the founding director of the Center on Law, Race, and Politics at Duke University. Good morning.
Good morning.
And here in studio with me is Dr. Michael Bitzer. You probably know him well. He is provost and political scientist at Catawba College. Good morning.
Good morning.
And in a moment, we will also be joined by Mitch Kokai, senior political analyst with the John Locke Foundation. I want to start, and we'll get into the specifics of the case here in a little bit, but I want to start with your overall view of the decision. And Guy, let's start with you.
So this decision is one in which the court concluded that North Carolina engaged in an unconstitutional racial gerrymander in the way that it drew the district lines, and it included too many African Americans in the district. So it intentionally diluted, unconstitutionally diluted the votes of African Americans. It concentrated them too much in a manner that is unconstitutional without sufficient justification. So that's the bottom line for the opinion. We can think and talk about the implications, but that's essentially what the court decided.
And at the heart of this case, Michael Bitzer, is a practice called packing. Explain that to us.
Yeah. You can think of packing as basically taking a collection of voters, of citizens, and putting them
with a united characteristic.
With a united characteristic, whether that's race, whether it could be any kind of characteristic, but the most consequential one so far has been race. And this harkens back to the 1980s. So North Carolina has a long history with this. But the idea of packing is basically to isolate those individuals with a common characteristic, typically into one or a few legislative districts, and then the resulting districts around those packed districts tend to favor the other party. So what we're dealing with here is not just race, but we're also dealing with politics. And that was part of the court's entry into this as well. But the idea of packing as opposed to perhaps cracking and making people kind of isolated into varying districts, diluting their voting strength, is something else as well. So there's a lot going on within this one case and this one process of redistricting.
And when it comes specifically to race, by concentrating them in the African-American voters in the 1st and the 12th congressional district, the court in essence found this was a violation of equal protection. It was a violation of the Voting Rights Act. And we'll get into the specifics on that as well. But this is something that the state, the lawyers for North Carolina, did not dispute in the case of the 1st district. They actually said, yeah, we were considering race in this case. And I want to play a little bit of the oral arguments from December. Paul Clement was the lawyer who represented North Carolina's the state of North Carolina in this case. And you'll hear his voice first, and then a question from Justice Elena Kagan. And CD, by the way, you'll hear Paul Clement say that. CD, by the way, is shorthand for congressional district.
We know how to tell you when we're taking race into account. We said we're doing it. We're not playing hide the ball here. We did it with respect to CD1. And when it comes to CD12, we look at the benchmark map. That's a political draw.
Well, the question is it, right? I mean, that's the question that the district court was trying to answer. Is it politics or is it race? If it's politics, it's fine. If it's race, it's not.
And that exchange between Paul Clement, who was representing the state of North Carolina, and Justice Elena Kagan raises so many interesting points, I think. And Guy, let me turn to you first quickly. The 1st district, they said flat out, the state said this was all about race. We wanted to increase the number of African-American voters from a number roughly in the 40s to more than 50%. What are your thoughts on that?
So the state's argument is the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, a particular provision of the Voting Rights Act, required us to create a district in which black voters were the majority of voters in that district. Otherwise, said the state, we would be subject to a violation of the act. And so in order to comply, from the state's perspective, that's their argument, in order to comply with the act, we created a majority black district. With respect to District 12, the state's argument was that that was not an intentional racial gerrymander. We didn't intentionally create a black district. We were trying to create a district that was majority Democrat. So they had two different sets of arguments. On the first one, the court said, you had no good reason to believe that you would have violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Now, if in fact you would have violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, that would be a reason for creating the first district as a majority black district. But given that you didn't have the requirements of Section 2 were not met, you didn't have a good reason for violating it, to believe that you would violate it, therefore, you didn't have a justification for intentionally taking race into account. Because you have to remember, whenever the government takes race into account intentionally, then the government has to justify why it is doing so. Without sufficient justification, it's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. So it had two arguments with respect to the two districts. And on the second, on the 12th district, the court said the lower court found that you were doing this as a racial gerrymander and not as a political gerrymander. And therefore, we're going to uphold the lower court's determination that it was a racial gerrymander, again, without sufficient justification. So two different types of arguments, but the state lost on both of them.
And Michael Bitzer, one thing I think some people will be surprised at is gerrymandering for political gain for a particular party so far is completely legal.
Completely legal and completely constitutional. The Supreme Court has always been wary of getting into what they call political questions, and redistricting and this process of gerrymandering is perhaps the most political activity that goes on nowadays in American politics. And layer on top of that, the hyperpolarization that we're all in, you know, the party that wins in a year ending in zero is in the driver's seat, because that then triggers the redistricting, the repopulation of these districts to make sure that they're basically equal to each other. And that allows the majority party to get involved and to say, we're going to stack the deck to our advantage. And based on partisanship, that is completely legal. Now, there's a catch. The door has been open for somebody to come to the Supreme Court by saying partisan gerrymandering is a violation of something, but that's down the road, and we'll have to see how some cases that are currently bubbling up play out.
There's also an interesting note. Justice Lena Kagan wrote the majority opinion in this case, and she wrote, if legislators use race as their predominant districting criterion with the end goal of advancing their partisan interests, their action still triggers strict scrutiny. You talk about a door being opened. I'm wondering if that line is actually the seeds of a future precedent when it comes to redistricting.
That's going to be an interesting dilemma. Now, I'd love to hear what Guy has to say on it. But I think that with the movement, particularly out of Wisconsin, with a case that's coming up to the Supreme Court, along with the new North Carolina maps that supposedly were drawn specifically on partisanship, we are going to draw a map one way or the other.
And these are congressional maps.
And these are the congressional maps. That could be, you know, the impetus to say, okay, now we really need to start looking heavily at partisanship.
All right, Guy, what do you think?
So two things. The first is that the standard equal protection doctrine, the standard way of thinking about this in law, is that whenever the government uses a proxy for race, so whenever race is the government's real end goal, but it's using a proxy for it, then the court is going to be basically saying that it's just the same thing as using race. So, for example, if in this particular case the state says, hey, what we really want to do is create a racial gerrymander, but we know that we can't do that explicitly, so we're going to use something that's a proxy for race in order to get at that same goal. And the court was, basically says, well, we're going to treat that as if you used race in the first instance. So that's essentially what the court is doing here, is applying standard equal protection doctrine in this particular context. The second part, which is that...
Well, actually, I'm going to stop you before you get to the second part, because sure. I do want to ask you one follow-up on your first part, which is, I understand your point, and a key point of that is the fact that overall, African-American voters tend to vote Democrat. But
that's correct.
Do you think that this is a new precedent or the seeds of a new precedent? I understand the argument, but what about that?
Mm-hmm. I don't know that it's the seeds of a new precedent. Part of it depends on how one reads the Cooper case. So a number of us election law experts have been battling this out over email and on listservs. The question is whether this case makes any new law or whether this case simply applies old law and makes it clear in this context. So and there are seeds for both arguments. On the one hand, one could say the court has never been this clear that using politics as a proxy for race gets you an equal protection clause violation. And so that's an argument for, hey, this is new, this is different, this makes it easier for example, to police political gerrymandering, because you can always bring that argument into play. No, they weren't creating a Democratic district. They were really interested in creating a racial district by creating a Democratic district. So that's the argument for new. The argument for old is, look, this is just standard equal protection clause doctrine. It's just that the court made it explicit in this context. So either of those are fair game in terms of a way of thinking about this case. Is that a sufficient dodge for you?
Yes, I will say yes. And I'm sure the listservs are full of those dodges.
I worked really hard at that.
We're talking race, politics, and congressional districting, and the finding of the U.S. Supreme Court that struck down two of North Carolina's congressional districts as racial gerrymanders. We want to know what you think about voting districts and how they should be drawn and by whom. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or at charlottetalks on Twitter and WFAE on Facebook. And we've got about a minute and a half before our break. I do want to welcome Mitch Kokai to the program. He is a senior political analyst with the John Locke Foundation. Good morning.
Good morning.
And I'm going to give you the same opportunity I gave Professor Charles and Professor Bitzer. What is your overall take on this case?
Well, I think one of the things that this case does is it does provide a little more clarity on where things stand with the law. I think one of the disappointing things, and this is something that was pointed out in the dissent, is that in some respects, it takes what seemed to have been a good test that could have been used in determining whether something is just a case of politics or is a case of racial gerrymandering, and threw it out. In fact, that was the lead line in Sam Alito's dissent, is that this was being treated as some sort of disposable item like a napkin that
or
you use
plate.
Once and throw
yeah,
away.
It was almost like he was channeling the late Antonin Scalia with a little bit of spicy writing in the dissent.
Right, especially in the sense that this is talking about the same district in which this first this test was applied for the first time, the 12th district, which everyone who follows election law knows is one of the strangest looking districts and has been for the 25 years it's been in place.
All right, Mitch, we're going to hold it there. We're going to take a short break, but we'll talk more about the dissent and continue our discussion about race and politics and racial gerrymandering. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Novant Health's Heart and Vascular Institute, providing treatment and solutions to help keep hearts beating strong. Information at novanthealth.org/hearthealth. And Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar, new location now open at The View in downtown Charlotte near BB&T Ballpark. Full portfolio of wine and beer from all over the world, plus live music. Details at thescrewcrew.com. For weeks, parents and the school board have been poring over the proposed student assignment plan at CMS. The original goal was to break up pockets of extreme poverty in the system. The result is immensely complex, and no one knows the complexities better than CMS Superintendent Ann Clark. Prior to the school board vote, she joins us to talk about the changes and her thought process. And we'll hear from members of the school board as well when Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
L.A. has the nation's highest number of homeless veterans, but it's taken years to make space for some of them on a 400-acre VA campus. Somehow the VA there did have room for gardens, a baseball stadium, even a parrot sanctuary.
It's mating season, so we hear a lot of the squawking on the campus here.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR News source.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Tom Bullock in for Mike Collins. We're talking racial gerrymandering and Monday's Supreme Court ruling with Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, Mitch Kokai from the John Locke Foundation, and Guy Charles with Duke Center on Law, Race, and Politics. And as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this case and the concept of using race as a determining factor to draw legislative boundaries, be they for Congress or for State House. You can reach out to us at CharlotteTalks on WFAE.org. That's our email address, or you can find at Charlotte Talks on Twitter and WFAE on Facebook. All right, so I want to, before we move on to the dissent, which is itself fascinating, I want to get to the point that the North Carolina, the lawyers who are representing the state say that the Republicans who drew the map pointed out it was reviewed and cleared in 2011 by the Obama-era Justice Department. At the time, that was required for North Carolina's congressional districts. And yet we don't have this case pop up until a few years ago after there have been numerous elections and this has already been pre-cleared. So is anyone surprised that not only that this case made it to the Supreme Court, but that the districts were indeed ruled racial gerrymanders? I mean, why didn't the Obama Justice Department just strike them down in the first place?
Well, I can't speak for the Obama Justice Department, but I can say that since the 1990s, it's not a redistricting cycle without a case going to the Supreme Court from North Carolina. I mean, this and particularly the 12th congressional district. The first is its own kind of creature with the population that it has down east, but the 12th congressional districts for new folks here in Charlotte, back in the 1990s, this district started in Gastonia, worked its way through Charlotte, ended up in Durham. And at about 160 miles of this kind of Rorschach test splatter plot.
It was
what was described as the I-85 district, because at one point the district was basically a freeway right-of-way that connected the parts of the district together. So the standing joke was you could park in that right-of-way and open your car doors and you could be in three congressional districts at one time. I think a state legislator made that. But this is where, you know, North Carolina plays such a critical role in election law because of past discriminatory actions, by coverage of the Voting Rights Act for such a long time, and now this integration of race and politics, the political behavior, and how that plays out in terms of creating these districts really puts North Carolina at the forefront.
Mitch, I'd like to know what you think about the fact that this was cleared by the Justice Department.
Yeah, you asked if there's any surprise. I know one group that was surprised was the Republican legislators who put these maps together, because basically the bottom line is they had two main goals when they drew these maps. One, elect as many Republicans as possible, and two, do it in a way that you think is going to get through the courts. So you could talk about racial gerrymandering. That was not their goal. Their goal was not to try to hurt the impact of the African-American vote. Their goal was to try to elect as many Republicans as possible. And both the 1st and 12th districts, if we look back at what happened with these were districts that were, in one form or another, in place for two decades. Basically, the Justice Departments, both Republican and Democratic Justice Departments, had said these districts were okay. So what the Republicans, who now run the General Assembly, when they were putting together these maps originally in 2011, said was, okay, we know that this 1st district and this 12th district have survived scrutiny in the past. What they did was tinker with it, and what the court has just ruled is that they tinkered too much. But what they did was tinker with those districts, get some more Democrats in there, which made all of the other other districts a little more Republican, giving them a chance. And as it turned out, not only the chance, but they actually followed through on that to win 10 Republican seats and have 3 seats held by Democrats. That was their goal. I think they thought because these districts, including that bizarre 12th district, had been upheld time after time for more than 2 decades, that they could make these changes. And they were trying to use, and the people who are more expert on this can tell me where they went wrong, but they tried to use a safe harbor of saying that, yes, this is a majority-minority district because there is slightly more than a 50% majority of minorities within that district. And as the court case said, wait a minute, you can't use that. That's not there is no bright line test of that sort. But I think that's what the Republican lawmakers were relying on.
Well, and
go ahead, please. Fairly quickly. So you have to think of two particular things. The first is that there are essentially 3 different standards that apply to these types of cases. So there's the Equal Protection Clause. There's Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and then there's Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. When the Justice Department does its review, under the old, we no longer have preclearance. Under the old, where you had to submit the districts if you were a covered jurisdiction to the DOJ, it does it under Section 5 review, which has a different requirement than either Section 2 or the 14th Amendment. So that's the first thing, is that there's a just different legal standards that apply to these types of cases. So the Supreme Court's decision was on the basis of the 14th Amendment. The review by the DOJ was on the basis of Section 5. Just a second quick point is that the Justice Department, particularly recently, would only overturn under Section 5 when it really believed that it was on very firm grounds, because the Supreme Court in the mid to late 90s had and imposed really strong supervision over what the Justice Department was doing. So they were a bit skittish. So only when they felt like they had really good reasons would they refuse to preclear a particular submission. So different legal rules that applied, and the Justice Department was relatively deferential unless it felt that there were good reasons to believe that retrogression, a legal violation, had taken place under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act.
So we have an email from Guy who writes, does the voter registration have a race checkbox? And if so, why? And the key question there is, how were map makers, I'm assuming this is his key question, how were they determining African-American voters as apart from a white voter?
Well, when you register to vote in North Carolina, you put down a number of different boxes you can check, and one of them is race. The other one is ethnicity. You can check which political party or unaffiliated status you want to be in. So the 6.7 million registered voters, we know what their racial category is if they checked it. Now, you can check unknown, and that's perfectly legal as well. But for the most part, people do tend to check those boxes.
And, Guy, I want to get back to you were just describing the Voting Rights Act. And it is fascinating to me, because this is something that the state lawmakers argued both in lower court and before the Supreme Court, that they were just following the Voting Rights Act by creating, majority-minority districts. Mm-hmm. As precisely as you can for an audience that's not well-versed in election law, what does the Voting Rights Act call on states to do when drawing political boundaries?
Okay. So there were 2 significant requirements for jurisdictions. The Section 5 requirement, which I said no longer is in play because the Supreme Court struck down the relevant provision. I won't get too specific on that because that's not that relevant. We might come back to that if you want to. For jurisdictions that are covered by Section 5, you had to submit redistricting or anything relevant or related to voting to the DOJ to make sure that you were not discriminating on the basis of race. All right, so that's a Section 5 requirement. Now, what the state was worried about with respect to the first district was Section 2, especially when it came to redistricting. And Section 2 basically has been interpreted by the Supreme Court to say, a minority voter can challenge a redistricting plan where the state has diluted its vote. And it's similar to what we were talking about earlier, where the state either cracks or packs the voter. So it takes a unified group and it disperses them to minimize their voting power, or it takes a group and it just puts them all in one voting district as a way of minimizing their influence in the surrounding districts. That's a violation of Section 2, where the minority voter meets three requirements, where you're large enough, where the white voting or the majority group votes as a block, and where there's something that's called racially polarized voting. That means that the minority group and the majority group just have different political preferences. Where you meet those three requirements, that is, you're a large enough group that they can put you in a single member district as a remedy. The white group or the majority group votes against your interests, and you have different political preferences than the majority groups. Those three requirements have to be met. Where those requirements are met, then you as the voter can file a Section 2 lawsuit. What the state was saying here, they were saying, hey, we were afraid of minority voters filing a Section 2 lawsuit where we would be found liable as violating their voting rights under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. That's what we were afraid of. Therefore, we drew a district in which black voters were the majority and over 50%. It was a majority-minority district because that's what we were afraid of. What the Supreme Court said was that, look, you couldn't have been afraid of that. You had no reasonable basis for being afraid of that because the three requirements were not met. The only justification for drawing a majority-minority district under Section 2 were if you had reason to believe that those three requirements, that you had a group that was large enough, that white voters voted against their interests, and that group had different interests than the white voters. And the court said, no, in this case, in fact, white voters voted with a black plurality to elect the candidate of choice of the black community. Therefore, those three requirements weren't met, and that can't serve as a justification for drawing the majority black district.
But it's a thorny—
Tom, can I leap in here, Tom?
You sure can, Mitch. Go ahead.
Sure. I think one of the things that has frustrated people who've been working on this for years and years, Democrats and Republicans who have been the map drawers, but especially now lately, of course, the Republicans, since they're the ones whose maps have been challenged, is that the court has not ever come out and definitively said, this is okay, this isn't okay. And so I think they've been wading through, we think this is okay based on past precedent, but we're not really sure. And I think everyone involved in drawing these maps would be really happy if the Supreme Court said, here's your standard. You've got to follow this. If you are putting a percentage of minorities that's higher than this, then that is a racial gerrymander. If you are acting in this way, this is a clear sign that it's a racial gerrymander. But the problem is, from the vantage point of the people who are doing this, with the express political goals, of course, of trying to maximize the advantage for their party, is that they've not been able to look at these past precedents and say, okay, if we go beyond this point, the court's clearly going to throw this out as a racial gerrymander. They basically said, well, we think we're okay if we do this based on the previous precedents. And as this latest case just revealed, that by trying to use these safe harbors of putting in enough minorities so that they have majority-minority districts, thus complying with what the courts had said in past rulings in the 1990s and 2000s, that they thought they were safe, but of course they're not. A majority of the Supreme Court said they weren't. And in fact, the entire court, all eight of them, didn't like what was done with District 1.
That's correct. But it's a real thorny issue. I have to say, somebody who is sharing your concern and that exact same question was Justice Stephen Breyer. And he did, in fact, vote with the majority in the case of the 12th Circuit. But let's listen to a question that he posed during oral arguments.
But what's, I think, going on in part is a very tough matter. And I mean, go back years ago.
Yes.
There were many states that had many black citizens and no black representation. And there was a thing called let's have majority-minority districts. And the problem is, how does the law permit the creation of that and at the same time prevent the kind of packing that might appear in other cases, which is gerrymandering? And no one, I think, has a good answer to that question. They're just slightly better, slightly worse. So if you're too tough in this case in rejecting the notion that it was politics, which is correlated with race, then what's going to happen out there to a successful effort to create majority-minority districts where matters change, times change, oceans rise, you know, et cetera.
And that really is the question at the heart of this. Is it possible, and I'll open this to anybody, is it possible to create a standard, that same standard that Justice Breyer is bemoaning the lack of, the same standard that Mitch Kokai has said it'd be great if the court came up with? Does anybody have that standard out there?
But before we get to that answer, one thing that also might help, I'm sorry to interrupt Professor Bitzer, but if we've not yet mentioned it, it's important to note that a lot of this goes back to the redistricting that was done after the 1990 census, when it was the first time that North Carolina was going to have a majority-minority district based on the determination that minorities were not getting the chance to vote for the candidates of their choice. The Democrats who ran the General Assembly at the time wanted to put together one majority-minority district. The Republicans who were in the minority, who looked at these numbers and said, wait a minute, if there are two majority-minority districts, that makes it easier for us to win all the other districts. So they went back to what was then the George H.W. Bush Justice Department and said, no, there should be two majority-minority districts in North Carolina. That's when we first came up with this crazy district up in the northeastern part of the state, the first district, and that Gastonia to Durham district that Professor Bitzer mentioned earlier. That was the Democrats' response to come up with a majority-minority district. But the way that they drew it, it still made Democrats have a good fighting chance to win a majority within the congressional delegation. So the history of this goes way back, and the first time these districts were drawn, they were drawn in such a way that minorities would have a chance to elect candidates of their choice in the two districts that were created. But at the time, the Democrats also wanted to draw it in such a way that they could still win a majority of the congressional delegation. Mm-hmm. Now, from the Republican vantage point, it's, all right, we've got these two majority-minority districts. Let's keep them like that. Then we'll create another Democratic district in the triangle, and we have a good shot of winning the other 10. That was their motivation, and the Supreme Court just stepped in and said that they erred in the way that they went about doing it.
Well, since Mitch has taken us back a little bit in the history books, one thing that does surprise me when you think of the history of claims of racial gerrymandering in North Carolina and in America writ large is the fact that the initial calls against racial gerrymandering came not from Democrats but from Republicans. This was originally their issue that they fought to have districts overturned because they saw, you know, again, overall African-American voters tend to vote Democrat. There are obviously crossover voters. It's not a unified block. But that change to me is significant, Dr. Bitzer.
It is. And what Republicans saw with the maps early on that Mitch referenced in the 1990s was that Republicans looked at these districts and said, how can a 160-mile district be compact? And that's a real concern and issue. And we can talk more about that after the break.
And we'll do that. You're listening to our conversation about racial gerrymandering and congressional districts in North Carolina. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Goodwill Industries of the Southern Piedmont, dedicated to breaking barriers to employment, training job seekers, and offering healthcare and banking at the Goodwill Opportunity Campus. Information at goodwillsp.org. And NC Warn, working to slow climate change by curbing methane emissions from the fracked gas and power industries. Information on clean energy alternatives at ncwarn.org. Coming up at 10 on Point, a horrifying attack in England at a concert attended by teenagers killed more than 22 people, leaving scores more injured. Initial reports indicate the attacker detonated a suicide vest outside the arena as people were leaving. British authorities have arrested a 23-year-old as ISIS claims responsibility, and President Trump recommits to the fight against terrorism. This hour on Point at 10 o'clock after Charlotte Talks, soft targets, ISIS threats, and talking to your children about terror. That's at 10 on Point, here on 90.7 WFAE.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Emmanuel Macron is officially the new president of France. He took over from outgoing leader François Hollande on Sunday.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
CMS officials say that's probably not going to happen because Huff, with more than 2,500 students, is overcrowded to the point where...
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Tom Bullock in for Mike Collins. And we're talking about the implications of the U.S. Supreme Court finding yesterday that North Carolina's 1st and 12th congressional districts are illegal racial gerrymanders. On our panel today are Mitch Kokai from the John Locke Foundation, Guy Charles from Duke University, and Michael Bitzer from Catawba College. And I'm going to turn very quickly to a question on that comes to us from Twitter. After this decision, what happens next? You can't redraw the two districts without changing others. How many? Well, I think the first thing to point out here is it's not clear to me that this decision necessitates the redrawing of any congressional districts.
Because we already have new congressional districts. What the legislature did last year was basically when the three-judge panel ruled on this original case, the legislature went back and basically drew new congressional districts. So the 12th, you know, went from the sprawling Charlotte to Greensboro all the way into Mecklenburg County. So it is a fundamentally different kind of district, but we're still a majority-minority district in terms of electing a black representative, Alma Adams. So, you know, the new maps that we have now are basically in place. What I think this portends to is the state legislative districts for state house and state senate, how those districts get viewed by the court, which could be as early as this week in terms of maybe kicking it back to the state or to the three-judge panel to say, review this in light of Monday's decision.
And that case is an interesting one because that is the case where a federal court has found that 28 of North Carolina's 170 statewide or state legislative districts, rather, were themselves racial gerrymanders. And what you're talking about is the Supreme Court announced after Monday's decision that on Thursday, their conference, which is where they talk about which cases they're going to bring up or will accept, that will be added to consideration, that they're going to think about whether or not to take that appeal. We could find about it. Yeah, exactly. As soon as Thursday. Let's talk specifically about that case, because the Supreme Court case that just came down may have direct implications. Guy, what do you think? Do you think the court will find that using the same criteria that were laid out in the congressional districts, that the state house districts were also racial gerrymanders?
So a couple of things. First, one of the things that you notice about this particular case, the Cooper versus Harris case, is how fact-intensive it is. That part of what the court did here was to rely upon the fact-finding of the lower court and to say we have to have some deference to the factual determinations of the lower court. So that tells us that the Supreme Court in this next case is likely to do the same. The second point is the fact that the court made it really clear that taking race into account brings in the Constitution, brings in the 14th Amendment. So there are a number of possibilities with respect to how do you determine intent. So Mitch mentioned earlier that, look, these folks were basically trying to do a political gerrymander. We worry and have worried about what we believe to be racial discrimination, sort of old-fashioned racial discrimination. Then there's the taking race into account sort of in the affirmative action type of a way. And then there is what we've talked about earlier as using politics as a proxy. And the court has to make a determination as to what is it that's going on here. To what extent is the government taking race into account sort of in the old-fashioned Jim Crow discrimination? To what extent is it taking race into account sort of in the affirmative action type of a way that one takes race into account? And to what extent does it believe that this is really politics as such? Or to what extent does it believe that this is using politics as a way to get at race? The case that we're talking about now, the court is going to have to make the similar type of determination. My guess is that this case, Cooper versus Harris, portends that the court will find in a similar way to the state legislative districts, but it's really hard to know exactly what the court is likely to do until we in fact see the opinion. But I think Cooper versus Harris gives us a hint that the court really is going to scrutinize the use of race in both congressional as well as state legislative district map making.
And Mitch, there's second case that is also making its way through federal court that has to do with these same two congressional districts, the 1st and the 12th, that have been found to be racial gerrymanders by the Supreme Court, but now are also being challenged as political gerrymanders because of how they were, as Dr. Bitzer was describing, redrawn. What are your thoughts there?
Right. It's probably a good point to give people sort of a housekeeping note on where things stand, because as you just mentioned and we've been discussing, the legislative districts case is in front of the Supreme Court. They could decide whether to take it up. The court already, without actually saying anything about it, has already stepped into this because the initial ruling from a three-judge panel called for special elections this year. Mm-hmm. And the court put a block on that. And
just while the appeals are going through.
Right. While the appeals are going forward, had put a block on that and had not had any other reaction on that case until deciding to put that case on its schedule to decide whether it's going to take it up. And I think you're right that most people who are looking at this are saying that the Cooper v. Harris ruling is probably giving a hint of the way the Supreme Court will rule on that case. But then looping back to your other case, as Professor Bitzer noted, there's not going to be any direct impact of this week's ruling on our congressional elections because those maps have already been thrown out and we had elections in 2016 under different maps. Now, interestingly enough, once those new maps were in place, the General Assembly and the state took the maps back to the court that had ruled the original 1st and 12th District case that had been an illegal racial gerrymander. That court did not have any problem with the new maps, but then we had two new lawsuits that were filed. One was led by Common Cause, led by the League of Women Voters, that were challenging our 2016 congressional election maps as a political gerrymander. Because in addition to racial gerrymandering, one of the other undecided topics within election law is how much political gerrymandering is too much unconstitutional gerrymandering. Going back to a case that I believe was from 2006 from Pennsylvania, you had a block of justices, basically the conservative block of justices, who said, no, political gerrymandering, this is a political issue. It's something the court should not touch. On the other side, the so-called liberal block said, no, too much political gerrymandering is unconstitutional, and no one should be surprised that the swing vote was Anthony Kennedy, who agreed with the liberal bloc that too much political gerrymandering could be unconstitutional, but he disagreed with them in that case on the remedy that they had that they would apply to that particular case. So for at least a decade now, people who are opposed to political gerrymandering and believe it's unconstitutional have been trying to come up with some sort of formula or legal test that would satisfy Anthony Kennedy. And at least one of the cases that's been filed against North Carolina's latest congressional election maps uses one of those tests, which is called the efficiency gap, which is way too complicated for us to get into. But it's something that has already succeeded in a case in Wisconsin that's working its way up to the Supreme Court. And it could be one that will come out of North Carolina as well, depending on what happens with this court case, which is going to the federal court level in late June.
I want us to back for a second and get to some listener comments. Dennis emails, I cannot understand why we've gotten to the point where representatives pick their voters rather than voters picking their representatives. Can any of your expert guests explain and justify this preposterous situation?
To the victor go the spoils.
That's it. Yeah.
And elections matter. And elections that end in a zero year matter the most, because what happens in that same year that ends in a zero is the census. And the census recounts everyone in the state and in the country. And then the following year, the legislature will have to redistrict and redraw to equalize out all these districts so that there is fairly equal population amongst the districts. And the majority party in the legislature does that.
And it's key to point out that what happened in 2010, the Tea Party wave.
Yeah, I mean that is the norm. That is the part of the political environment that swept the Republicans into power to control the legislature. They got to control the redistricting process, drawing the new maps, and they basically, in my mind, bought themselves an insurance policy by creating these districts, based partly on the fact that we as voters are so polarized and so many of us are so loyal to our partisan tendencies that districts aren't really hard to draw to favor one party over the other.
Another person
and if
emails.
I may just add one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
One
Dean,
very
go
good
ahead.
Point. Also, which is the fact that the Constitution delegates to the states the responsibility for these types of line drawings, so the state and the state legislatures. So, in other countries, for example, they may have what they might call a boundary commission or nonpartisan entity for doing these types of line drawings. In our country, under our constitutional structure, that's given to the political process. And so that's another, right, that's sort of a basic starting point that differentiates us from other places in which those tasks are given to nonpartisan entities.
And I would be falling down on my job as a member of the North Carolina Coalition for Lobbying and Government Reform if I didn't mention that there have been ongoing active efforts to try to change our redistricting process. There is some legislation that's moving forward. And actually, if you look back in recent history, as recently as 2011, I believe it was, the State House overwhelmingly passed the idea of redistricting reform. But it's something that has not ever had any tangible support in the state Senate. And even in the House now, some of the people who were for it now before they were against it, going back to that terminology. So there is an active effort to try to change this process. The John Locke Foundation is one of the groups that's working with partners across the political spectrum working on this whole idea of redistricting reform, but it's been a tough road to hoe.
Well, Joshua and Karen on Facebook, they each have basically the same point in slightly different ways. Joshua writes, districts should be drawn by a nonpartisan commission. Mm-hmm. Karen writes, why, oh, why can't we get independent redistricting? Where is independent redistricting or nonpartisan, true nonpartisan redistricting being used in America?
Well, the most common state to reference in terms of nonpartisan is in Iowa. Iowa is always pointed to as kind of the poster child of a process where conceivably politics is taken out and that a kind of neutral approach to drawing districts is taken in. The problem becomes when you start to introduce, particularly with geographic political sorting, you know, Democrats tend to reside in major urban areas. Republicans are in heavily concentrated in rural areas. It doesn't take a whole lot of effort by a map drawer to basically create districts around these areas that really help one party over the other. And we have become so polarized in our voting patterns that this is just kind of the groundswell of it working. Now, if you didn't tell me your party registration or give me any kind of election results, yeah, you could draw districts, basically slicing and dicing the state up into, you know,
but you couldn't.
Different.
You absolutely could not, at least with congressional districts, because there is a federal mandate about the population. And if you have a higher concentration of, you know, more people live in urban areas than in rural areas. So you have to consider, specifically with congressional districts, a set population count per district.
And then throw on top all of these Supreme Court opinions that I'm sure a geek can talk more about. You know, this is where map drawers are basically confronted with all of these different factors that they have to take into account, along with state constitutional dynamics, particularly in North Carolina, the whole county principle. All of that is like, okay, which card do I play to draw these districts?
All right, Gee, what do you think? Could a nonpartisan or a true bipartisan commission in a state like North Carolina end this issue of gerrymandering for based either on race or party affiliation and to gain political advantage?
Well, end, I think, is too high of a standard. So I think
Fair
they enough. Can ameliorate. There's no doubt about that. right? Because you can draw it in a way that that does not explicitly favor a particular party. But I think Michael makes a wonderful point, which is given the polarized and sorting world that we live in, and this is a world in which people would much rather their son or daughter marry someone of the – they don't mind if their son or daughter marries someone of a different race as long as they don't marry someone of a different party, right? So that's the world – and that's the current world in which we're living. It's like, yeah, go ahead, out marry in terms of race, but please don't bring me somebody of the out party. So we're living in – we're choosing where to live or we're living in areas near people who think and behave the same way as we do. And so it doesn't take much for the map drawer to know or to draw districts with groups that are quite similar because the geographic sorting is happening, has already happened, and continues to happen. So even if you have bipartisan or nonpartisan or independent, Arizona is a good example. The what's going on in California now in terms of redistricting reform is another good example. So we have some good models. Nothing is perfect, however. And so if we're looking for perfection, that's too high of a standard, though we can improve on this current process.
It's probably worth noting as well that the redistricting reform bill that is in the North Carolina General Assembly and has yet to have a hearing is based in large part on that Iowa model that we've been talking about.
All right. Go ahead, Dr. Pitzer. We've got about 30 seconds.
This is going to be an interesting test, and what the Supreme Court comes back with on the state legislative districts really opens up the next stage in this whole entire process as well.
So this is Agreed. The literal stay tuned.
It is very right. much the political stay tuned.
Well, that's all the time we have this morning. I want to say thank you to Dr. Michael Pitzer with Catawba College, Professor Guy Charles with Duke University Center on Law, Race, and Politics, and Mitch Kokai from the John Locke Foundation. Thank you all for the hour.
Pleasure.